Disc 5.
Chapter 15. Normandy, France. Early the next morning, Eric Lange crossed the English Channel on the New Haven to Dieppe ferry. He parked his rented Peugeot in a public lot near the ferry terminal and walked to the Quai Henri IV for breakfast. In a café overlooking the harbour, he had brioche and café au lait and read the morning papers. There was no mention of the murder of British investigative journalist Peter Malone, nor had there been any news on the radio. Lange was quite certain the body had not yet been discovered. That would take place at approximately 10 o'clock, London time, when his research assistants arrived for work. The police, when they launched their investigation, would have no shortage of suspects. Malone had made many powerful enemies over the years. Any one of them would have been more than happy to end Malone's life. Lange ordered more brioche and another bowl of coffee. He found that he was in no hurry to leave. The long night of driving had left him drowsy, and the idea of spending the day travelling back to Zurich depressed him. He thought of Katrina, her secluded villa on the edge of a dense Norman forest, the pleasures that could be found in her enormous, canopied bed. He left a few euros on the table and walked along the quay to the Poissonnerie, Dieppe's old covered fish market. He moved from stall to stall, carefully examining the catch, chatting easily with the fishmongers in perfect French. He selected a pair of lovely sea bass and an assortment of shellfish. Then he left the market and headed for the Grand Rue, Dieppe's main shopping street. He bought bread from the boulangerie and several fresh farm cheeses from the charcuterie. His last stop was the Cave, where he purchased a half dozen bottles of wine and a Calvados, the famed apple brandy of Normandy. He loaded the food into the back seat of the Peugeot and set out. The road hugged the edges of the cliffs, rising and falling with the contour of the coastline. Below lay a rocky beach. In the distance, a line of fishing boats was motoring into port. He passed through a string of quaint fishing towns, devouring one of the baguettes while he drove. By the time he reached Saint-Valery-en-Caux, the car smelled strongly of shrimp and mussels. A mile before Saint-Pierre, he turned into a narrow local road and followed it inland through apple orchards and fields of flax. Just beyond the village of Valmont, he turned onto a narrow track lined with beech trees and followed it for a kilometre or so until it dead-ended at a wooden gate. Beyond the gate stood a stone villa, concealed in the shadows of tall beech and elm. Katrina's red jeep was parked in the gravel drive. She would still be asleep. Katrina rarely found a reason to get out of bed before noon. Lange climbed out, opened the gate, then drove onto the grounds. Without knocking, he tried the front door and found it locked. He had two options: bang until Katrina woke up, or begin his visit with a bit of fun. He chose the latter. The villa was shaped like a U, and surrounded by a tangled garden. In summer it was a riot of colour. Now, in the last days of winter, it was sombre green. Beyond the garden rose the outer edges of the forest. The trees were bare, and the limbs lay motionless in the still of the morning. In the centre of the house was a stone courtyard. Lange picked his way through a minefield of broken flower pots, careful to make no sound, and started trying the latches on each of the six sets of French doors. The fifth was unlocked. Silly Katrina, thought Lange. He would teach her a lesson she wouldn't soon forget. He let himself inside, and padded across the shadowed sitting room to the staircase, then climbed up to Katrina's room. He peered inside. The curtains were drawn. Lange could see Katrina in the half-light, her hair strewn across the pillow, her bare shoulders poking from the top of a white duvet. She had the olive skin of a southerner, and the blue eyes and blonde hair of a Norman girl. The red highlights were a gift from a Breton grandmother, as was her explosive temper. Lange eased forward, hand reaching for the spot beneath the blanket where her foot appeared to be. Just as he was about to seize her ankle, Katrina sat bolt upright in bed, eyes wide, hands wrapped around a Browning 9mm pistol. She squeezed off two quick shots, just as Lange had taught her. In the confines of the bedroom, the explosions sounded like cannon fire. Lange fell to the floor. The rounds sailed overhead, shattering the mirror in Katrina's stunning 200-year-old armoire.
Don't shoot, Katrina, Lange said, laughing helplessly. It's me. Stand up. Let me see you.
Lange slowly got to his feet, hands in plain sight. Katrina switched on the bedside lamp and gave him a long, fiery look. Then she drew back her arm and threw the gun at his head. Lange ducked, and the gun fell harmlessly onto the pile of glass shards.
You fucking bastard! You're lucky I didn't blow your head off.
I wouldn't have been the first.
I loved that mirror.
It was old. It was an antique, you asshole. I'll buy you a new one.
I don't want a new one. I want that one.
So we'll get it fixed. And how will I explain the bullet holes? Lange put his hand on his chin and made a show of thought. Actually, that might be a problem.
Of course it's a problem, asshole!
She pulled the duvet over her breasts, as if aware of her nudity for the first time, and her anger at him began to soften.
What are you doing here, anyway?
I was in the neighborhood. She gazed at his face for a moment.
You've killed again. I can see it in your eyes.
Lange picked up the Browning, set the safety, and dropped the gun on the end of the bed.
I was working nearby, he said. I need a day or two of rest. What makes you think you can drop in here whenever you please? I might have had another man here.
You might have, but the odds were in my favor. You see, I am aware that, with few exceptions, most men bore you to tears, intellectually and in that grand bed of yours. I am also aware that any man you bring here isn't likely to last long. Therefore, I felt it was well worth the gamble.
Katrina was trying desperately not to smile.
Why should I let you stay here?
Because I'll cook for you.
Well, in that case, we should work up an appetite. Come to bed. It's too early to get up.
Katrina Boussard was quite possibly the most dangerous woman in France. After earning degrees in literature and philosophy from the Sorbonne, she had joined the French left-wing extremist group, Action Directe. While the political aims of the group may have fluctuated wildly, its tactics remained consistent. Throughout the 80s, it carried out a blood-soaked rampage of assassinations, kidnappings, and bombings that left scores dead and a nation terrorized. Thanks to the instruction she received from Eric Lange, Katrina Boussard was one of the group's most accomplished killers. Lange had worked with her on two occasions, the 1985 assassination of a senior official in the French Ministry of Defense and the 1986 assassination of a French auto executive. In each case, it was Katrina Boussard who applied the coup de grâce to the victims. Lange usually worked alone, but in the case of Katrina, he made an exception. She was a skilled operative, cold and pitiless in the field, and highly disciplined. She and Lange suffered from a similar affliction. Operational stress increased their desire for sex, and they had used each other's bodies to great effect. They were not lovers. They had both seen too much to believe in something as pedestrian as love. They were more like skilled craftsmen in pursuit of perfection. Katrina had been blessed with a body that provided her inordinate pleasure in any number of places. As always, she responded readily to Lange's touch. Only when she was completely satiated did she turn her considerable skills upon Lange. She was a torturous lover, so in tune with Lange's body that each time he was about to lose control, she released him and left him to suffer without absolution. When he could stand no more, Lange took matters into his own hands, grasping Katrina by the hips and thrusting himself inside her from behind. It was closer to conquest than he would have preferred, but it was exactly how Katrina had planned it. As Lange reached his climax, his head rolled back, and he shouted like a madman at the ceiling. Katrina was looking over her shoulder at him, watching him with a look of deep satisfaction, for she had beaten him once again. When it was over, she lay with her head on his chest, and her hair strewn across his stomach. Lange looked out the French doors at the trees on the edge of the forest. A storm had moved in from the channel, and the trees were bent by the wind. Lange toyed with Katrina's hair, but she did not stir. Because they had killed together, Lange could make love to her without inhibition and without the latent fear that he might reveal something of himself. He did not love Katrina, but he was fond of her,
In fact, she was the only woman he truly cared for at all.
I miss it so, she murmured.
What's that, Katrina?
The fight.
She turned her face to him. Now I sit here in Valmont, living on the trust fund of a father I despise, and wait to grow old. I don't want to grow old. I want to fight.
We were foolish children. Now we're wiser.
And you kill for anyone, as long as the price is right, of course. Langer put a finger on his lips.
I never had the benefit of a trust fund, Katrina.
Is that why you're a professional assassin?
I have certain skills, skills that the marketplace demands.
You sound like such a proper capitalist. Haven't you heard? The capitalists won. The forces of good have been crushed beneath the heel of profit and greed. Now you can eat McDonald's and visit Euro Disney whenever you please. You've earned your quiet life and your beautiful villa. Sit back and enjoy the satisfaction of a noble defeat.
You're such a hypocrite, she said.
I prefer to think of myself as a realist.
Who are you killing for?
Men we once despised, he thought. Then he said,
You know the rules, Katrina. Close your eyes.
When Katrina was asleep, Langer slipped from the bed, dressed quietly, and went outside. He opened the trunk of the Peugeot and removed Peter Malone's laptop computer, then tucked it beneath his coat, and trotted back into the villa through the rain. Inside he made a fire of applewood and settled himself on the comfortable couch in Katrina's sitting room. He lifted the computer's cover, switched on the power, and waited for it to boot up. Under his agreement with Carlo Casagrande, Langer was obliged to deliver the computer and the other things he had taken from Malone's office to a safe deposit box in Zurich. While the computer was still in his possession, he had no qualms about taking a look for himself. He opened Malone's documents folder and inspected the dates and times of the latest entries. In the final hour of his life, the reporter had created two new documents, one entitled Israeli Assassin, the second labeled Benjamin Stern, Murder. Langer felt a lightness in his fingertips. Outside, the wind of the Channel storm sounded like a passing bullet train. He opened the first file. It was a remarkable document. Shortly before Langer had entered Malone's flat, the investigative journalist had interviewed a man who claimed to be an Israeli assassin. Langer read the file with a certain professional admiration. The man had had quite a colorful and productive career. Black September, a couple of Libyans, an Iraqi nuclear scientist, Abu Jihad. Langer stopped reading and looked out the French doors at the trees twisting in the storm. Abu Jihad? Had the killer of Abu Jihad truly been in Malone's apartment a few hours before Langer? If it was true, what on earth was he doing there? Langer was not a man who put much stock in coincidence. The answer, he suspected, could be found in the second document. He opened it and started to read. 5 minutes later, Langer looked up. It was worse than he had feared. The Israeli agent who had calmly walked into Abu Jihad's villa in Tunis and killed him was now investigating the murder of Professor Benjamin Stern. Langer wondered why the Jewish professor's death would be of interest to Israeli intelligence. The answer seemed simple. The professor must have been an agent of some sort. He was furious with Carlo Casagrande. If Casagrande had told him that Benjamin Stern was connected to Israeli intelligence, he might very well have refused the contract. The Israelis unnerved him. They played the game differently than the Western Europeans and the Americans. They came from a tough neighborhood, and the shadow of the Holocaust hung over their every decision. It led them to deal with their adversaries in a ruthless and pitiless fashion. They had pursued Langer once before after a kidnapping and ransom operation he had carried out on behalf of Abu Jihad. He had managed to slip through their fingers by taking the rather draconian step of killing all his accomplices. Langer wondered whether Carlo Casagrande was aware of the Israelis' involvement, and if he was, why he hadn't hired Langer to deal with it. Perhaps Casagrande didn't know how to find the Israeli. Thanks to the documents on Peter Malone's computer, Langer did know how to find him. and he had no intention of waiting for orders from Casa Grande to act. He had a slight advantage, a brief window of opportunity, but he had to move swiftly, or the window would close. He copied the two files onto a disk, then erased them from the hard drive. Katrina, wrapped in the duvet from her bed, came into the room and sat down at the other end of the couch. Langer closed the computer.
"You promised to cook for me," she said. "I'm famished."
"I have to go to Paris."
"Now?"
Langer nodded.
"Can't it wait until morning?"
He shook his head.
"What's so important in Paris?"
Langer looked out the window. "I need to find a man."
Rashid Husseini did not look much like a professional terrorist. He had a round, fleshy face and large brown eyes, heavy with fatigue. His wrinkled tweed jacket and turtleneck sweater gave him the appearance of a doctoral student at work on a dissertation he could not quite finish. It wasn't far from the truth. Husseini lived in France on a student visa, though he rarely found time to attend his courses at the Sorbonne. He taught English at a language center in a dreary Muslim suburb north of Paris, did the odd bit of translation work, and occasionally wrote incendiary commentary for various left-wing French journals. Eric Langer was aware of the true source of Husseini's income. He worked for a branch of the Palestinian Authority few people knew about. Rashid Husseini, student, translator, journalist, was chief of European operations for the PLO's Foreign Intelligence Service. Husseini was the reason Eric Langer had come to Paris. Langer telephoned the Palestinian at his apartment on the Rue du Tournon. An hour later they met in a deserted brasserie in the Luxembourg Quarter. Husseini, a secular Palestinian nationalist of the old school, drank red wine. Alcohol made him talkative. He lectured Langer on the suffering of the Palestinian people. It was virtually identical to the diatribe he had inflicted on Langer in Tunis 20 years ago, when he and Abu Jihad were trying to seduce Langer into working for the Palestinian cause. The land and the olive trees, the injustice and the humiliation. "The Jews are the world's new Nazis," Husseini opined. "In the West Bank and Gaza, they operate like the Gestapo and the SS. The Israeli Prime Minister, he's a war criminal who deserves the justice of Nuremberg." Langer bided his time, stirring his coffee with a tiny silver spoon, and nodding sagely at appropriate moments. He couldn't help but feel sorry for Husseini. The war had passed him by. Once it had been waged by men like Rashid Husseini, intellectuals who read Camus in French and screwed stupid German girls on the beaches of Saint-Tropez. Now the old fighters had grown fat on handouts from the Europeans and Americans, while children, the precious fruit of Palestine, were blowing themselves up in the cafes and markets of Israel. Finally, Husseini threw his hands up in a helpless gesture like an old man who knows he has become a bore. "Forgive me, Eric, but my passion always gets the better of me. I know you don't come here tonight to talk about the suffering of my people. What is it? Are you looking for work?" Langer leaned forward over the table.
"I was wondering whether you might be interested in helping me find the man who killed our friend in Tunis."
Husseini's tired eyes came suddenly to life.
"Abu Jihad? I was there that night. I was the first one to enter the study after that Israeli monster had done his evil work. I can still hear the screaming of Abu Jihad's wife and children. If I had the opportunity, I'd kill him myself."
"What do you know about him?"
"His real name is Alon, Gabriel Alon, but he's used dozens of aliases. He's an art restorer. Used his job as cover for his killings in Europe. An old comrade of mine named Tariq al-Hurani put a bomb beneath Alon's car in Vienna about 12 years back and blew up his wife and son. The boy was killed. We were never sure what happened to the wife. Alon took his revenge against Tariq a couple of years ago in Manhattan."
"I remember," Langer said, "that affair with Arafat."
Husseini nodded.
"You know where he is?"
"No. But I think I know where he's going."
"Where?"
Langer told him.
"Rome. Rome is a big city, my friend. You're going to have to give me more than that."
"He's investigating the murder of an old friend. He's going to Rome to find an Italian detective named Alessio Rossi. Follow Rossi, and the Israeli will fall into your lap. Husseini jotted the name in a small leather-bound notebook and looked up. Carabinieri, Polizia di Stato?
The latter, said Langer,
and Husseini wrote P.S. in the book. The Palestinian sipped his wine and studied Langer a long moment without speaking. Langer knew the questions running through Husseini's mind. How did Erich Langer know where the Israeli assassin was going? And why did he want him dead? Langer decided to answer the questions before Husseini could ask them.
He's after me. It's a personal matter. I want him dead, and so do you. In that respect, we have common interests. If we work together, the matter can be resolved in a way that suits us both.
A smile spread over Husseini's face.
You were always a very cool customer, weren't you, Erich? Never want to let your emotions get the better of you. I would have enjoyed working with you.
Do you have the resources in Rome to mount a surveillance operation against a police officer?
I could follow the Pope himself. If the Israeli is in Rome, we'll find him. But that's all we're going to do. The last thing the movement needs at the moment is to engage in extracurricular activity on European soil.
He winked. Remember, we've renounced terrorism. Besides, the Europeans are the best friends we have.
Just find him, said Langer. Leave the killing to me.
Part 3. A Pensione in Rome. Chapter 16. Rome. The Abruzzi had fallen on hard times. Located in the San Lorenzo quarter between Stazione Termini train station and the Church of Santa Maria Maggiore, its mustard-colored facade looked as though it had been raked by machine-gun fire, and the lobby smelled of cat litter. Despite its tumble-down appearance, the little pensione suited Gabriel's needs perfectly. The headquarters of the Polizia di Stato was a short walk away, and unlike most pensiones in Rome, each room in this one had a telephone. Most importantly, if Crux Vera was searching for him, the last place they would look was the Abruzzi. The night manager was an overweight man with round shoulders and a florid face. Gabriel checked in under the name Heinrich Siedler and spoke to him in labored Italian with a murderous German accent. The manager appraised Gabriel with a pair of melancholy eyes, then jotted down his name and passport number in the hotel registry. Gabriel crossed a cluttered common room, where a pair of Croatian teenagers was engaged in a ferocious ping-pong match. He trod silently up the soiled staircase, let himself into his room, and locked the door. He entered the bathroom. The rust stains in the sink looked like dried blood. He washed his face, then removed his shoes, and collapsed onto the bed. He tried to close his eyes, but could not. Too exhausted to sleep, he lay on his back, listening to the tap-a-tap-a-tap of the table tennis match downstairs, reliving the last 24 hours. He had been travelling since dawn. Instead of flying directly from London to Rome, which would have required him to clear customs at Fiumicino Airport, he had flown to Nice. At the airport there, he had paid a visit to the Hertz outlet, where a friend of the office called Monsieur Henri had rented him a Renault sedan in such a way that it could never be traced back to him. From Nice, he drove toward Italy along the A8 autoroute. Near Monaco, he switched on the English-language Radio Riviera to catch a bit of news on the war in the territories, and learned instead that Peter Malone had been found shot to death in his London home. Parked at the side of the motorway, traffic hurtling past, Gabriel had listened to the rest of the report with his hands strangling the steering wheel and his heart banging against his ribs. Like a chess grandmaster, he had played out the moves and saw disaster looming. He had spent 2 hours inside the reporter's home. Malone had taken copious notes. Surely the Metropolitan Police had discovered those notes. Because of the intelligence connection, they had probably briefed MI5. There was a very good chance every major police force and security service in Europe was looking for the Israeli assassin codenamed Sword. The safe thing to do? Call Shamron on an emergency line, arrange a bolt hole, and sit on the beach in Netanya until things cooled down. But that would entail surrendering the search for Benjamin's killers, and Malone's. He pulled back onto the autoroute and accelerated toward Italy. At the border, a drowsy guard admitted him into the country with a languid wave of his hand. And now, after an interminable drive down the Italian peninsula, he found himself here, in his sour-smelling room at the Abruzzi. Downstairs, the table-tennis match had deteriorated into something of a new Balkan war. The shouts of the aggrieved party filled Gabriel's room. He thought of Peter Malone, and wondered whether he was responsible for his death. Had he led the killers to him, or had Malone already been marked for elimination? Was Gabriel next on the list? As he drifted towards sleep, he heard Malone's warning careening about his memory. If they think you pose a threat, they won't hesitate to kill you. Tomorrow he would find Alessio Rossi. Then he would get out of Rome as quickly as possible. Gabriel slept poorly, and was awakened early by the ringing of church bells. He opened his eyes and blinked in the severe sunlight. He showered and changed into fresh clothing, then went downstairs to the dining room for breakfast. The Croatians were nowhere to be seen, only a pair of churchy American pilgrims and a band of noisy college students from Barcelona. There was a sense of excitement in the air, and Gabriel remembered that it was a Wednesday, the day the Holy Father greeted pilgrims in St. Peter's Square. At 9 o'clock, Gabriel returned to his room and placed his first call to Inspector Alessio Rossi of the Polizia di Stato. A switchboard operator put him through to the detective's voicemail.
"My name is Heinrich Siedler," Gabriel said. "I have information regarding Father Felici and Father Manzini. You can reach me at the Pensione Abruzzi."
He hung up. Now what? He had no choice but to wait and hope the detective called him back. But there was no television in the room. The bedside table had a built-in radio, but the tuning knob was broken. After 1 hour of paralyzing boredom, he dialed the number a second time. Once again, the switchboard officer transferred him straight to Rossi's voicemail. Gabriel left a second message, identical to the first, but with a faint note of urgency in his voice. At 11:30, he placed a third call to Rossi's number. This time he was put through to a colleague, who explained that the inspector was on assignment and would not be back in the office until late afternoon. Gabriel left a third message and hung up. He decided to use the opportunity to get out of the room. In the streets around the church of Santa Maria Maggiore, he checked his tail for signs of surveillance and saw nothing. Then he walked down the Via Napoleone III. The March air was crisp and clear and scented with wood smoke. He ate pasta in a restaurant near the Piazza Vittorio Emanuele II. After lunch, he walked along the looming western facade of the Stazione Termini, then wandered among the classical edifices of Rome's government quarter until he found the headquarters of the Polizia di Stato. In a cafe across the street, he drank espresso and watched officers and secretaries filing in and out, wondering whether Rossi was among them. At 3 o'clock, he started back toward the Pensione Abruzzi. As he was crossing the Piazza di Repubblica, a crowd of about 500 students entered the square from the direction of the Università Romana. At the head of the procession was an unshaven boy wearing a white headband. Around his waist were sticks of mock dynamite. Behind him, a group of pseudo-mourners carried a coffin, fashioned of cardboard. As they drew closer, Gabriel could see that most of the demonstrators were Italian, including the boy dressed as a suicide bomber. They chanted, "Liberate the land of Palestine," and "Death to the Jews," not in Arabic, but in Italian. A young Italian girl, no more than 20, thrust a leaflet into Gabriel's hand. It depicted the Israeli Prime Minister, dressed in the uniform of the SS, with a Hitlerian toothbrush mustache, the heel of his jackboot, crushing the skull of a Palestinian girl. Gabriel squeezed the leaflet into a ball and dropped it onto the floor. He passed a flower stall. A pair of carabinieri were flirting shamelessly with the girl who worked there. They looked up briefly as Gabriel strode by and stared at him with undisguised interest before turning their attention once more to the girl. It could have been nothing, but something about the way they looked at him, made sweat run over Gabriel's ribs. He took his time walking back to the hotel, careful to make sure no one was following him. Along the way he passed a bored carabiniere on a motorcycle, parked in a patch of sunlight, watching the madness of a traffic circle with little interest. Gabriel seemed to intrigue him even less. He entered the Pensione Abruzzi. The Spaniards had returned from the Wednesday audience in a state of great excitement. It seemed that one of them, a girl with a spiked haircut, had managed to touch the Pope's hand. Upstairs in his room, Gabriel dialed Rossi's number.
Pronto?
Inspector Rossi?
Si. My name is Heinrich Siedler. I called earlier today. Are you still at the Pensione Abruzzi?
Yes.
Don't call here again.
Click. Night fell, and with it came a Mediterranean storm. Gabriel lay on his bed with the window open, listening to the rain smacking against the paving stones in the street below, while the conversation with Alessio Rossi played over and over in his head like a loop of audio tape. Are you still at the Pensione Abruzzi?
Yes. Don't call here again.
Clearly the Italian detective wished to speak with him. It was also clear that he wanted no more contact with Herr Siedler on his office telephone. Gabriel had no choice but to wait him out and hope Rossi would make the next move. At 9 o'clock, the telephone finally rang. It was the night manager.
There's a man here to see you.
What's his name?
He didn't say. Shall I send him away?
No. I'll be down in a minute.
Gabriel hung up the phone and stepped into the corridor, locking the door behind him. Downstairs, he found the night manager seated behind the front desk. No one else was there. Gabriel looked at him and shrugged. The night manager pointed a sausage-like forefinger toward the common room. Gabriel entered, but found the room deserted, except for the Croatian table tennis players. He went back to the front desk. The Italian threw his hands up in a gesture of surrender, and turned his attention to a miniature black-and-white television. Gabriel climbed the stairs to his room. He unlocked the door and stepped inside. He saw the blow coming, a glint of light on black metal sweeping toward him in an arc, like a shimmering swath of wet paint across blank canvas. Too late, he raised his hands to shield his head. The butt of a pistol crashed against the base of his skull behind his left ear. The pain was immediate. His vision blurred. His leg seemed suddenly paralyzed, and he felt himself corkscrewing downward. His attacker caught him and eased him soundlessly to the linoleum floor. He heard Peter Malone's warning one last time. If they think you pose a threat, they won't hesitate to kill you. And then only the sound of the table tennis match downstairs in the common room. Tap-a-tap-a-tap. When Gabriel awakened, his face was burning. He opened his eyes and found himself staring into a halogen bulb, not more than an inch from his face. He closed his eyes and tried to turn his head. Pain shot through the back of his skull like a second blow. He wondered how long he had been out. Long enough for his attacker to bind his mouth and wrists with packing tape. Long enough for blood to dry against the side of his neck. The light was so close, he could see nothing more of the room. He had the sense that he had not left the Abruzzi. This was confirmed when he heard shouting in Serbo-Croatian. He was on his own bed. He tried to sit up. A gun barrel seemed to flow out of the light. It pressed against his breastbone and pushed him back onto the mattress. Then a face appeared. Heavy shadows beneath the eyes, stubble on the square chin. The lips moved. Sound reached Gabriel's ears. In his delirium, it seemed like a film out of sync, and his brain required a moment to process and comprehend the words he had just heard.
My name is Alessio Rossi. What the fuck do you want?
Chapter 17. Rome. The young man sitting astride the motorino on the Via Gioberti had an air of bored insolence typical of Roman teenagers. He was not bored, nor was he a teenager, but a 30-year-old Vigilanza officer assigned to Carlo Casagrande's special section of the Vatican Security Office. His youthful appearance proved an asset in his present assignment. the surveillance of Inspector Alessio Rossi of the Polizia di Stato. The Vigilanza man knew only what he needed to know about Rossi. A troublemaker, the inspector, poking his nose into places it didn't belong. At the end of each shift, the officer returned to the Vatican, then typed up a detailed report and left it on Casagrande's desk. The old general always read the Rossi reports the moment they came in. He had taken a special interest in the case. Rossi had been acting suspiciously. Twice that day, once in the morning and again in the late afternoon, he'd driven an unmarked car from headquarters to the Via Gioberti and parked there. The Vigilanza man had observed Rossi staring at the Pensione Abruzzi, like a man who suspected his wife was having an affair upstairs. After the second visit, the officer contacted an informant in Rossi's department, a pretty young girl who answered the telephones and handled the filing. The girl told him that Rossi had received several telephone calls that day from a guest at the Abruzzi, offering information about a cold case. The guest's name? Siedler, the informant had answered. Heinrich Siedler. The Vigilanza man had a hunch. He climbed off the motorino and entered the pensione. The night manager looked up from a pornographic magazine.
Is there a man named Heinrich Siedler staying in this hotel?
The night manager shrugged his heavy shoulders. The Vigilanza officer slid a pair of euro notes across the counter and watched them disappear into the manager's grubby paw.
Yes, I believe we have a man called Siedler staying here. Let me check.
He made a vast show of consulting the registry book.
Ah, yes, Siedler.
The man from the Vatican pulled a photograph from the pocket of his leather jacket and laid it on the counter. This produced a non-committal frown from the night manager. His face brightened at the appearance of more money.
Yes, that's him, that's Siedler.
The Vigilanza man scooped up the picture.
What room?
The apartment on the Via Pinciana was too large for an old man living alone. Vaulted ceilings, a spacious sitting room, a broad terrace with a sweeping view of the Villa Borghese. On nights when Carlo Casagrande was tormented by memories of his wife and daughter, it seemed as cavernous as the Basilica. Had he still been a mere Carabinieri general, the flat would have been well beyond his reach. But because the building was owned by the Vatican, Casagrande paid nothing. He felt no guilt about living well on the donations of the faithful. The flat served not only as his residence, but as his primary office as well. As a result, he took precautions that his neighbors did not. There was a Vigilanza man permanently at his door, and another in a car parked on the Via Pinciana. Once a week, a team from the Vatican Security Office scoured the flat to make sure it was free of listening devices. He answered the telephone on the first ring, and immediately recognized the voice of the Vigilanza man assigned to the Rossi case. He listened in silence while the officer filed his report, then severed the connection and dialed a number.
I need to speak to Bartoletti. It's an emergency.
I'm afraid the director is unavailable at this time.
This is Carlo Casagrande. Make him available.
Yes, General Casagrande. Please hold.
A moment later, Bartoletti came on the line. Casagrande wasted no time on pleasantries. We have received information that the papal assassin is staying in room 22 of the Pensione Abruzzi in the San Lorenzo Quarter. We have reason to believe he is armed and very dangerous. Bartoletti hung up. Casagrande lit a cigarette and began the wait. In Paris, Eric Langer brought his cellular phone to his ear and heard the voice of Rashid Husseini.
I think we may have found your man.
Where is he?
Your Italian detective has been acting peculiar all day. He just went inside a pensione called the Abruzzi, a real shithole near the train station.
What street?
The Via Gioberti.
Langer looked at his watch. There was no way to get to Rome tonight. He'd have to leave in the morning.
Keep him under surveillance, he said. Call me if he moves.
Right.
Langer rang off, then dialed Air France reservations and booked a seat on the 7:15 flight. Chapter 18. Rome. Rossi pressed the gun against Gabriel's forehead and tore the packing tape from his mouth.
Who are you?
Greeted by silence, the policeman ground the barrel painfully into Gabriel's temple.
I'm a friend of Benjamin Stern.
Christ! That explains why they're looking for you.
Who?
Everyone. Polizia di Stato, the Carabinieri. They've even got the SISDE after you. With the gun still firmly in place, Rossi removed a slip of facsimile paper from his jacket pocket and held it before Gabriel's eyes. Gabriel squinted in the harsh light. It was a photograph, grainy and obviously shot with a telephoto lens, but clear enough for him to see that the face of the subject was his own. He looked at the clothing he was wearing and realized it was the clothing of Ehud Landau. He searched his memory. Munich, the Olympic Village. Vice must have been following him then, too. The photograph rose like a curtain, and Gabriel found himself staring once more into the face of Alessio Rossi. The detective smelled of sweat and cigarettes. His shirt collar was damp and grimy. Gabriel had seen men under pressure before. Rossi was on the edge. This photo has been sent to every police station within 100 miles of Rome. The Vatican Security Office says you've been stalking the Holy Father. It's not true. The Italian finally lowered the gun. The spot on Gabriel's temple where the barrel had been pressed throbbed for several seconds. Rossi turned the light toward the wall and kept the gun in his right hand, resting against his thigh. How did you get my name? Gabriel answered truthfully. They killed Malone, too, Rossi said. You're next, my friend. When they find you, they're going to kill you. Who's they? Take my advice, Herr Siedler, or whatever the fuck your name is. Get out of Italy. If you can leave tonight, so much the better. I'm not leaving until you tell me what you know. The Italian tilted his head. You're not really in a position to make demands, are you? I came here for one reason, to try to save your life. If you ignore my warning, that's your business. I need to know what you know. You need to leave Italy. Benjamin Stern was my friend, Gabriel said. I need your help. Rossi eyed Gabriel a moment, his gaze tense. Then he rose and walked into the bathroom. Gabriel heard water running into the basin. Rossi returned a moment later holding a wet towel. He rolled Gabriel onto his side, unbound his wrists, and gave him the damp cloth. Gabriel cleaned the blood from the side of his neck while Rossi walked to the window and parted the pair of gauzy curtains. "Who do you work for?" he asked, staring into the street. "Under the circumstances, it's probably better that I don't answer that." "Jesus Christ," Rossi murmured. "What on earth have I gotten myself into?" The detective pulled a chair close to the window and took another long look into the street. Then he switched off the light and told Gabriel the story from the beginning. Monsignor Cesare Felici, an elderly and long-retired priest, went missing from his room at the College of San Giovanni Evangelista one evening in June. When the Monsignor didn't return by the following evening, his colleagues decided it was time to report the matter to the police. Because the college did not have Vatican territorial status, jurisdiction fell to Italian authorities. Inspector Alessio Rossi of the Polizia di Stato was assigned the case and went to the college early that evening. Rossi had investigated crimes involving the clergy before and had seen the rooms of priests. Monsignor Felici's struck him as inordinately Spartan. No personal papers of any kind, no diary, no letters from friends or family, just a couple of threadbare cassocks, an extra pair of shoes, some underwear and socks, a well-fingered rosary. A silice. Rossi interviewed 20 people that first night. They all told similar stories. The day of his disappearance, the old Monsignor had taken his usual afternoon stroll in the garden before going to the chapel for prayer and meditation. When he didn't appear for supper, the seminarians and other priests assumed he was tired or not feeling well. No one bothered to check on him until late that evening, when they discovered that he was gone. The head of the college provided Rossi with a recent photograph of the Monsignor, along with a brief biography. Felici was no pastoral priest. He'd spent virtually his entire career working inside the Vatican as a functionary in the Curia. His last assignment, according to the dean,
was a staff position at the Congregation for the Causes of Saints. He'd been retired for 20 years. Not much to go on, but Rossi had started cases with less. The next morning, he entered the missing priest's particulars on the Polizia di Stato database and distributed the photograph to police forces across Italy. Next, he searched the database to see if any other clergy had vanished lately. Rossi had no hunches and no working theory. He just wanted to make certain there wasn't a nut running around the country murdering priests. What Rossi discovered shocked him. 2 days before Felici's disappearance, another priest had vanished, a Monsignor Manzini who lived in Turin. Like Felici, Monsignor Manzini was retired from the Vatican. His last position was in the Congregation for Catholic Education. He lived in a retirement home for priests, and like Monsignor Felici, he seemed to have vanished without a trace. The second disappearance raised a number of questions in Rossi's mind. Were the two cases linked? Did Manzini and Felici know each other? Had they ever worked together? Rossi decided it was time to talk to the Vatican. He approached the Vatican Security Office and requested the personnel files for each of the missing priests. The Vatican denied Rossi's request. Instead, he was given a memorandum that purported to summarize the curial careers of each priest. According to the memorandum, both had worked in a series of low-level staff assignments, each more trivial than the last. Frustrated, Rossi asked one more question. Did they know each other? They may have bumped into each other socially, Rossi was told, but they had never worked together. Rossi was convinced that the Vatican was hiding something. He decided to bypass the security office altogether and get the complete files for himself. Rossi's wife had a brother who was a priest assigned to the Vatican. Rossi pleaded for help, and the priest reluctantly agreed. A week later, Rossi had copies of the complete personnel files. Did they know each other? One would assume so. You see, both Felici and Manzini worked in the Secretariat of State during the war. Which section? The German desk. Rossi took a long look into the street before continuing. About a week later, he had received a response to his original request for reports of other missing clergy. This one didn't match the criteria perfectly, but the local police had decided to forward the report to Rossi anyway. Near the Austrian border, in the town of Tolmezzo, an elderly widow had vanished. Local authorities had given up the search, and she was now presumed dead. Why had her disappearance been brought to Rossi's attention? Because, for 10 years, she had been a nun, before renouncing her vows in 1947 in order to marry. Rossi decided to bring his superiors into the picture. He wrote up his findings and presented them to his section chief, then requested permission to press Vatican authorities for more information on the two missing priests. Request denied. The nun had a daughter living in France in a town called Le Rouret in the hills above Cannes. Rossi requested authorization to travel to France to question her. Request denied. Word had come down from on high that there was no link between the disappearances and nothing to be found by poking around behind the walls of the Vatican. Who sent down the word? The old man himself, Rossi said, Carlo Casagrande. Casagrande, why do I know that name? General Carlo Casagrande was the chief of counter-terrorism at l'Arma dei Carabinieri during the 70s and 80s. He's the man who routed the Red Brigades and made Italy safe again. For that, he's something of a national hero. He works for the Vatican Security Office now, but inside the Italian intelligence and security community, he's still a god. He's infallible. When Casagrande speaks, everyone listens. When Casagrande wants a case closed, it's closed. Who's doing the killing? Gabriel asked. The detective shrugged. We're talking about the Vatican, my friend. Whoever's behind it, the Vatican doesn't want the matter pursued. The code of silence is being strictly enforced, and Casagrande is using his influence to keep the Italian police on a short leash. The nun who disappeared in Tolmezzo, what was her name? Regina Carcassi. Find Sister Regina and Martin Luther. Then you'll know the truth about what happened at the convent. And what was the name of the convent where she lived during the war, before she renounced her vows?
Some place up north, I think.
Rossi hesitated for a moment, searching his memory.
Ah, yes, the convent of the Sacred Heart. It's on Lake Garda, in a town called Brenzoni. A nice place.
Something in the street below caught Rossi's attention. He leaned forward and pulled aside the curtain, peering through the window intently. Then he leaped to his feet and seized Gabriel's arm.
Come with me, now!
The first police officers poured through the front door of the pensione. Two plainclothes polizia de Stato, followed by a half-dozen carabinieri with submachine guns across their chests. Rossi led the way across the common room, then down a short corridor, to a metal door that opened onto a darkened interior courtyard. Gabriel could hear the police hammering up the stairs toward his empty room. They had successfully eluded the first wave. More were sure to follow. Across the courtyard was a passageway leading to the street that ran parallel to the Via Gioberti. Rossi grabbed Gabriel by the forearm and pulled him toward it. Behind them, on the second floor of the pensione, Gabriel could hear the carabinieri breaking down his door. Rossi froze as two more carabinieri came through the passageway at a run, weapons at the ready. Gabriel gave Rossi a shove, and they started moving again. The carabinieri reached the courtyard and clattered to a stop. Immediately, their submachine gun swung up to the firing position. Gabriel could see that surrender was not an option. He dived to the ground, landing heavily on his chest, as the first rounds scorched over his head. Rossi was not quick enough. A shot struck him in the shoulder and threw him to the ground. The Beretta fell from his grasp and landed 3 feet from Gabriel's left hand. Gabriel reached out and pulled the gun to him. Without hesitating, he rose to his elbows and started firing. One carabiniere fell, then the other. Gabriel crawled over to Rossi. He was bleeding heavily from a wound to his right shoulder.
Where did you learn to shoot like that?
Can you walk?
Help me up.
Gabriel pulled Rossi to his feet, wrapped his arm around the Italian's waist, and shepherded him toward the passageway. As they passed the two dead carabinieri, Gabriel heard shouting behind him. He released his hold on Rossi and scooped up one of the submachine guns, then dropped to one knee and raked the side of the pensione with automatic fire. He heard screaming and saw men diving for cover. Gabriel grabbed a spare magazine, rammed it into the weapon, and shoved Rossi's Beretta 9mm into the waistband of his trousers. Then he hooked his arm through Rossi's left elbow and pulled him through the passageway. As they neared the street, two more carabinieri appeared. Gabriel fired instantly, blowing both men from their feet. As they reached the pavement, Gabriel hesitated. From the left, a car was racing toward him, lights flashing, siren blaring. From the right, 4 men were approaching on foot. Across the street was the entrance of a trattoria. As Gabriel stepped forward, shots erupted from inside the passageway. He lunged to his left, behind the cover of the wall, and tried to pull Rossi toward him, but the Italian was hit twice in the back. He froze, his arms flung wide, his head back, as one final round tore through the right side of his abdomen. There was nothing Gabriel could do for him now. He sprinted across the street and threw open the door of the restaurant. As he burst into the dining room with the machine gun in his hands, there was pandemonium. In Italian, he shouted, "Terrorists! Terrorists! Get out! Now!" Everyone in the room rose in unison and rushed toward the door. As Gabriel ran toward the kitchen, he could hear frustrated carabinieri screaming at the patrons to get out of the way. Gabriel raced through the tiny kitchen, past startled cooks and waiters, and kicked open the back door. He found himself in a narrow alleyway, not 4 feet wide, foul-smelling and dark as a mineshaft. He slammed the door behind him and kept running. A few seconds later, the door flew open again. Gabriel turned and sprayed the alleyway with gunfire. The door slammed shut. At the end of the alley, he came to a broad boulevard. To his right was the facade of the church of Santa Maria Maggiore. To his left, the expanse of the Piazza Vittorio Emanuele. He dropped the submachine gun in the alley and crossed the street, weaving his way through the traffic. Sirens rang out from every direction. He wound his way through a chain of narrow streets, then dashed across another busy boulevard, the Via Merulana, and found himself at the edge of the vast park surrounding the Colosseum. He kept to the darkened footpaths. Carabinieri units were already searching by flashlight, which made them easy to see and avoid.
10 minutes later, Gabriel came to the river. At a public telephone on the embankment, he dialed the number he had never before been forced to use. It was answered after one ring by a young woman with a pleasant voice. She spoke to him in Hebrew. It was the sweetest sound he had ever heard. He spoke a code phrase, then recited a series of numbers. There were a few seconds of silence while the girl punched the numbers into a computer. Then she said, "What's wrong?"
"I'm in trouble. You need to bring me in."
"Are you hurt?"
"Not badly." "Are you safe in your present location?"
"For the moment, but not for long.
Call back in 10 minutes. Until then, keep moving."
Chapter 19. Rome. The Via Gioberti was ablaze with flickering blue emergency lights. Achille Bartoletti stepped out of the Pensione Abruzzi and spotted Carlo Casagrande's car amid the turmoil. The Italian security chief came over at an easy executive stroll and climbed into the back seat.
"Your assassin is damned good with a gun, General. I hope he never gets anywhere near the Holy Father."
"How many dead?"
4 carabinieri killed, 6 others wounded."
"Dear God," Casagrande murmured.
"I'm afraid there's one other casualty, a Polizia di Stato detective named Alessio Rossi. Apparently he was inside the assassin's room when the carabinieri went in. For some reason, Rossi tried to escape with him."
Casagrande feigned surprise. The tone of Bartoletti's next question revealed that he did not find his performance altogether convincing.
"Is there something about this affair you've neglected to tell me, General?"
Casagrande met Bartoletti's quizzical stare and slowly shook his head.
"I've told you everything I know, Achille."
"I see."
Casagrande tried to quickly change the subject.
"What is Rossi's condition?"
"He's dead too, I'm afraid."
"Was it the Israeli?"
"No, it appears he was shot by carabinieri."
"Is there anything in the room?"
"Just a change of clothes, no papers, no identification. Your man is good."
Casagrande looked up at the open window on the second floor of the pensione. He had hoped the matter could be handled quietly. Now he had to use the circumstances to his advantage.
"Based on his performance tonight, it is clear to me that this man is a professional."
"I cannot argue with that conclusion, General.
As for Rossi, perhaps he was involved somehow in the conspiracy."
"Perhaps,"
Bartoletti said with little conviction.
"Whatever the circumstances, the Israeli must not be allowed to leave Rome.
100 officers are looking for him right now.
He won't stay in Rome long. He'll leave at the first opportunity. If I were you, I'd seal the city, put a watch on every train station and bus terminal."
Bartoletti's expression betrayed that he didn't appreciate being treated like an incompetent who needed to be told how to mount a search for a fugitive.
"I'm afraid this affair has little to do with the Vatican at this point, General Casagrande. After all, 5 Italian policemen were killed on Italian soil. We will conduct the search in the manner we see fit and inform the Vatican Security Office as events warrant."
"The pupil has turned on his master,"
thought Casagrande. Such was the nature of all relationships like this.
"Of course, Achille," he said submissively. "I meant no disrespect."
"None taken, General. But I wouldn't hold out much hope that this man is going to simply vanish. Speaking for myself, I'd like to know what Inspector Rossi was doing in his room. I would think you'd like to know that, too."
Bartoletti climbed out of the car without waiting for a reply and walked briskly away. Casagrande's driver looked up into the rearview mirror.
"Back to the Via Pinciana, General?"
Casagrande shook his head.
"Il Vaticano."
In a souvenir kiosk near the Forum, Gabriel bought a dark blue hooded sweatshirt with the words "Viva Roma" emblazoned across the chest. In a public toilet, he removed his shirt and stuffed it into a rubbish bin. Only then did he notice that a bullet had grazed his right side, leaving a bloody furrow below his armpit. He used toilet paper to wipe away the blood, then carefully pulled on the new sweatshirt. Rossi's beretta was still wedged into the waist of his jeans. He went out and headed north toward the Piazza Navona. He had made his second call on the emergency line. The same woman had answered the phone and had told him to go to the church of Santa Maria della Pace. Inside, near the confessionals, would be a man in a tan overcoat with a folded copy of L'Osservatore Romano. The agent would tell Gabriel where to go next. His first responsibility now was to his rescuers. He had to be certain he was not leading them into a trap. As he wound his way through the warren of narrow streets and alleyways in the Centro Storico, he mingled with tourists and ordinary Romans, keeping clear of main thoroughfares. He could still hear the wail of police sirens in the distance, but was confident no one was following him. In the Piazza Navona, carabinieri were patrolling in pairs. Gabriel pulled up his hood and settled into a group of people, watching a man play classical guitar next to a fountain. He looked up and saw that the northern end of the piazza was free of police. He turned, crossed the square, and followed a narrow alley to the entrance of the church. A beggar was sitting on the steps. Gabriel slipped past and went inside. The smell of incense greeted him. He thought of Venice, the stillness of San Zaccaria. Just 2 weeks ago he was at peace, restoring one of the most important paintings in all of Italy. Now he was being hunted by every policeman in Rome. He wondered whether he would ever be allowed to go back to his old life again. He paused before the basin of holy water, thought better of it, and eased forward into the nave. An old woman was on her knees before a bank of memorial candles. Opposite the doors of the confessional sat the man in the tan overcoat. On the pew was a copy of L'Osservatore Romano, folded in half. Gabriel settled in next to him.
"You're bleeding," said the man in the overcoat.
Gabriel looked down and saw that the side of his sweatshirt was indeed soaked with blood.
"Do you need a doctor?"
"I'll be fine. Let's get out of here."
"Not me. I'm just a messenger."
"Where do I go?"
"There's a silver BMW motorcycle parked outside the church. The driver is wearing a crimson helmet."
Gabriel walked outside. The motorcycle was there. As Gabriel approached, the driver pressed the starter button and revved the engine into life. Gabriel threw his leg over the back and wrapped his arms around the driver's waist. The bike turned into traffic and sped in the direction of the river. It did not take Gabriel long to realize that the agent driving the motorcycle was a woman. The hourglass hips, the narrow waist and slender blue-jeaned thighs, the bunch of hair poking from the bottom of the helmet. It was curly and smelled of jasmine and tobacco. He was certain he had smelled it before. They raced along the Lungo Tovere. To his right, Gabriel could see the dome of St. Peter's looming over the Vatican Hill. Crossing the river, he hurled Alessio Rossi's Beretta into the black water. They headed up the Janiculum Hill. At the Piazza Saresi, they turned into a sleepy, sloped residential street lined with stone pines and small apartment houses. The bike slowed as they approached an old palazzo that had been converted into a block of flats. The woman killed the engine, and they coasted beneath an archway, coming to a stop in a darkened courtyard. Gabriel dismounted and followed her into the foyer, then up two flights of stairs. She unlocked the door and pulled him inside. In the darkened entrance hall, she unzipped her leather riding jacket and removed her helmet. Her hair tumbled over her shoulders. Then she turned on the lights.
"You," said Gabriel.
The girl smiled. It was Chiara, the rabbi's daughter, from Venice. For the second time that evening, Eric Langer's cellular phone chirped softly on the bedside table of his Paris hotel room. He brought it to his ear and listened silently while Rashid Husseini told him about the gun battle at the Pensione Abruzzi. Obviously, Carlo Casagrande did know about Alon, and he had sent a mob of incompetent Italian policemen to do the job when it could have been handled quite easily by one good man with a gun. Langer's window of opportunity to deal with Alon himself may have just closed permanently.
"What are you doing now?" Langer asked.
"We're looking for him, along with half the police in Italy. There's no guarantee we're going to find him. The Israelis are good at getting their people out of tight spots."
"Yes, they are," said Langer. "In fact, I'd say the Rome station of the Israeli Secret Service is very busy tonight. They've got quite a crisis on their hands."
"Indeed they do.
Have you identified any of their personnel in Rome?"
"Two or three that we're sure of," Husseini said. "It might be wise to follow them. With a bit of luck, they'll lead you straight to him." You remind me of Abu Jihad, Husseini said. He was brilliant, too. I'm coming to Rome in the morning. Give me your flight information. I'll have a man meet you. Gabriel spent a long time in the shower, washing his wound and scrubbing the blood from his hair. When he emerged, wrapped in a white towel, Chiara was waiting for him. She cleaned his wounds carefully and bound his abdomen in a heavy dressing. Lastly, she gave him a shot of antibiotics and handed him a pair of yellow capsules. What's this?
Something for the pain. Take them. You'll sleep better.
Gabriel washed down the tablets with a swig of mineral water from a plastic bottle.
I laid some clean clothes for you on the bed. Are you hungry?
Gabriel shook his head and walked into the bedroom to change. He was suddenly unsteady on his feet. While he was on the run, being fed by nerves and adrenaline, he had not felt the pain. Now his side felt as though it had a knife in it. Chiara had left a blue sweatsuit on the bed. Gabriel carefully pulled it on. It was for a man several inches taller, and he had to roll up the sleeves and cuff the pant legs. When he came out again, she was sitting in the living room, watching a bulletin on the television. She took her eyes from the screen long enough to glance at him and frown at his appearance.
I'll get you some proper clothes in the morning.
How many dead?
5, she said, several more wounded.
5 dead. Gabriel closed his eyes and fought off a wave of nausea. A burst of pain shot through his side. Chiara, sensing his distress, laid a hand on his face.
You're burning, she said. You need to sleep.
I've always found sleep difficult at times like this.
I understand, I think.
How about a glass of wine?
With the painkillers? It might help you.
A small one.
She went into the kitchen. Gabriel aimed the remote at the television, and the screen went black. Chiara returned and handed him a glass of red wine.
Nothing for you?
She shook her head.
It's my job to make sure you stay safe.
Gabriel swallowed some of the wine.
Is your name really Chiara Zoli?
She nodded.
Are you really the rabbi's daughter?
Yes, I am.
Where are you posted? Officially, I'm attached to Rome Station, but I do a fair amount of traveling.
What sort of work?
Oh, you know.
A little of this, a little of that.
And that routine the other night?
Shamron asked me to keep an eye on you while you were in Venice. Imagine my surprise when you walked into the community center to see my father.
What did he tell you about our conversation?
That you were asking him a lot of questions about the Italian Jews during the war and about the convent of the Sacred Heart on the Lago di Garda.
Why don't you tell me the rest?
Because I don't have the strength, he thought.
And then he said, how long do I have to stay here?
Pasner will tell you everything in the morning.
Who's Pasner?
Chiara smiled.
You have been out of the game for a while. Shimon Pasner is head of Rome Station. At the moment he's trying to figure out how to get you out of Italy and back to Israel.
I'm not going back to Israel.
Well, you can't stay here.
Shall I turn on the television again? Every policeman in Italy is looking for you.
But that's not my decision. I'm just a lowly field hand. Pasner will make the call in the morning.
Gabriel was too weak to argue with her. The combination of the painkillers and the wine had left him feeling heavy-lidded and numb. Perhaps it was for the best. Chiara helped him to his feet and guided him into the bedroom. As he lay down, pain shot through his side. He settled his head carefully on the pillow. Chiara switched off the light and sat in an armchair at the side of the bed, a beretta in her lap.
I can't sleep with you there.
You'll sleep. Go into the other room. I'm not allowed to leave you.
Gabriel closed his eyes. The girl was right. After a few minutes, he slipped into unconsciousness. His sleep was aflame with nightmares. He fought the gun battle in the courtyard for a second time and saw Carabinieri drenched in blood. Alessio Rossi appeared in his room, but in Gabriel's dream he was dressed as a priest, and instead of a beretta, it was a crucifix he aimed at Gabriel's head. Rossi's death, with his arms flung wide and his side pierced by a bullet, Gabriel saw
as a Caravaggio. Leia came to him. She stepped down from her altarpiece and shed her robes. Gabriel stroked her skin and found that her scars had been healed. Her mouth tasted of olives. Her nipples, pressed against his chest, were firm and cool. She took him inside her body and brought him slowly to climax. As Gabriel released inside her, she asked him why he had fallen in love with Anna Rolf. "It's you I love, Leia," he told her. "It's you I'll always love." He awakened briefly. The dream was so real he expected to find Leia in the room with him. But when he opened his eyes, it was the face of Kiara he saw, sitting in her chair, watching over him, a gun in her hand.
This book is continued on Disc 6.